not believe it's acting as an inductor. I believe it's acting purely in a mechanical fashion to keep the antenna contained within the rubber cone, so you can't pull a rubber cone off the antenna. If you lost the ball, the static ball off the other end of the antenna, you could pull it out that way, but not the way it normally goes. You can't pull the antenna rod up and pull it through the rubber cone.
Does the RF energy flow through that curlicue? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, it does.
Then what in the world is stopping it from being a series inductor? The fact that it is small in diameter, and you think it's going to have very few microhenries, you only need a few nanohenries at the base of the antenna to make a hell of a difference in the tuning. Is that electronically active as a series inductor at the base of that antenna? Mechanically, you're telling me it's too small, it can't be, but electronically, you're telling me it is. I begin to think there's a real inductor at the base of that antenna. Over to you, Joe.
KD2HUC with a comment.
As I said, you're not grasping this, and if I physically showed you what the antenna looks like, the very common antenna is, then you say, oh, that's what it looks like. Yes, it does look like it could be an inductor, but you're showing it out on all sides of the bottom of this as it's touching the contact of the antenna mount. So thinking of it as it being an inductor is kind of hard to imagine. It is acting as truly as an inductor. It looks more like it's mechanical than anything else.
Okay, we've got Eric, Hal, and Steve in that order. KE2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIWK2EJ. I'm listening to this and it reminds me of something that's close but not exactly the same. When it comes to NMO mounts, it took me a while to figure this out. This is a bunch of years ago. Installed an antenna, light smacks in the center of the roof, and unfortunately at that time I didn't have one of those antenna specialist hole saws, which does this wonderful job of moving the paint. So that way the bottom of the NMO connector, by the way, NMO stands for New Motorola, makes really good contact to the sheet metal that is the roof. And after a while, taking the thing apart, seeing the paint was there, after scraping the paint away, the visual started coming down into places where you expected it to be. Oh, and by the way, I have an antenna question for you after all of this. K2RWK, just.
Okay, Eric, you're on the list. Next person on the list to make comment on all of the above. Hal, K6DBZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
Add me to the list for a question on it also, Dick.
You're already on the list. But go ahead, Hal.
Okay, I just have one question. If you take an ohm meter at the end of the coax, whether do you have resistance on the end of the coax, ohmage, or is it open?
That's a question to you, Joe.
If you take the antenna off the NMO mount, you read infinity for resistance.
With the antenna on, normally the antenna on, just looking at the other end of the coax, what are you reading, an open or a short?
A complete DC open.
The antenna connected normally and everything, you're on top of the car.
With the antenna installed on top of the mount, on the car roof, if you put an ohm meter across the cable, you read a complete DC open circuit.
Okay, and what's the length of the antenna?
The range of this antenna is 150 to 162, and the nominal length of the antenna rod from end to end 17.75 inches. That's what this discussion is about. Because if you calculate it like I did, allowing for the rod being about a 16th of an inch diameter approximately, the calculations don't seem to work out correctly. That's what this discussion is all about. It seems like the antenna has to be longer, and it's really shorter than the theoretical calculations lead you to believe. And the next range antenna and the next range down for 2 meters, and I've used these already, is 19 and an eighth inches. And that's either a 144 to 150 antenna or maybe 136 to 150. I forget the exact specification. But the other one I do remember, it's a 150 to 162 range antenna at 17.75 inches end to end.
Okay, 2 at the base. So having a curly 2 at the base, you may be increasing the antenna physical length and also using it as an impedance matching device with the capacitance of that curly 2 to the metal part of the car.
Okay, well, I really believe that the antenna is more constructed more for mechanical purposes than anything else with this arrangement, because all the antennas on all their bands, the curly Q is made exactly the same way. The only thing that changes is the physical length of the whip, whether it's UHF, low band, low part, low UHF, high UHF, VHF, on different ranges, the curly Q is all the same, the way you physically look at it.
How many turns are in that curly Q, Joe?
One turn. It goes around, not even completely once, because like I said, the end of it does not quite touch the antenna rod. Like I said, describing it, if you've never seen it before, imagine you make a circle at the end of the antenna rod. You bend the thing to make a small circle about 3/16 of an inch diameter, and then took that whole circle and turned it 90 degrees to the antenna rod, with the antenna rod being the center of the circle. That's how the thing looks physically.
Let's see what Steve's got to say on this thing. Maybe you own one of these things, Steve. KD2HUC, K2IW, the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Yes, I do own one. As a matter of fact, if you check your email, I just sent you a picture of the base so you can see what Joe was talking about. I always assumed that that was there for contact pressure. The rubber boot allowed the antenna to move. I would say probably 20 to 25 degrees off axis, you know, if it should strike something or whatnot. And to me, it looks more like a spring mechanism to keep contact with the base, you know, should the antenna be moved from 90 degrees. It doesn't appear to me to be any type of loading coil, because the contact, if the antenna is at exactly 90 degrees to the base, the contact is putting pressure on all 360 degrees of that loop. But like I said, if you check your email, I shot you a picture of it so you can see what Joe's talking about. KD2HUC.
That's a beautiful picture. Did you just take that picture right now to send that to me, Steve? Wow. Oh, you, Steve.
That's an antenna that I use VHF for the railroad radio, and that's the antenna for it. So yeah, I just grabbed it off my Jeep and snapped a picture of it for you.
Oh, what took so long? That's a joke. Fantastic. Okay, so I've got a picture of it now, and so no. Okay, if 19 inches gives you 2 meters at around 146 megs, so to speak, and 17 and 3/4 inches gives you 156 meg center. What's really going on here, Joe, is I'm beginning to think that the velocity factor of this antenna is not 0.97. In the case of an 80 meter dipole made out of a 14 gauge household wire, the usual velocity factor people use is 0.95. This whip is considerably thicker in length to diameter ratio compared to an 8th inch or 16th inch diameter. A 14 gauge wire is very close to a 16th inch diameter. So if an antenna 132 feet long is 16th of an inch in diameter, and now you've got something here that's more than a 16th of an inch in diameter, just by a tiny amount, but it's only 17 inches long and not 132, you've got a much bigger thickness ratio. Therefore, I think your velocity factor is closer to 0.95, 0.93, and maybe that's the explanation, Joe. And so you're not differing by a huge amount here. I mean, your antenna seems to be tuning. You and I could plug in the right velocity factor number, and it would come out right. And you really built this thing. I mean, you've really tested this thing. And so we're just using the wrong mathematics. I think you've got an effective antenna. W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Okay, now that you saw that you actually saw a nice, clear, large color picture, was I wrong in my description to you?
return coil at the base. I see it's not. I see the way it's captured. I agree that that's not an inductor. You're probably making contact to the NMO base on that curly Q. You're probably, the curly Q looks to me like, let me see it again. I'm going to give you a rough guess. It goes, not 360, it goes up 320 degrees, so to speak, and you're making contact across that whole 320 degrees. There's no real inductor there. So the only explanation as to how this antenna does such a beautiful job of resonating is that we're using the wrong velocity factor. The only thing I can explain it as, Joe, either that or can't believe that he said it's steel. I know that stainless steel has got a ridiculously high resistivity compared to copper. I ran into that problem with a project a couple of years ago where I actually compared the resistivity of stainless steel compared to the nichrome wire you and I wind wire-wound resistors out of. And stainless steel ain't that far away from nichrome wire in high resistivity. So that's another factor that's going on here. I'll bet you if you ran this antenna key down with 100 watts going into it for 5 minutes, turn off the transmitter, and you grab the base of the antenna, I think you're going to feel some warmth because of the stainless steel. And I'm guessing stainless steel because they don't want it rusting. W2RYY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, I agree with you with the velocity factor. I may have been wrong on my calculation. Using 0.97 may have been wrong. Maybe it's about 0.93, 0.92, something like that. I mean, I can work things backwards in the formula, and knowing the resonant frequency, I could come back and, you know, tell you what I think the velocity factor would be used in the formula, okay? That's not really a big deal. But to answer your second thing, what you said about running transmitter power to it, I have done that test, especially on UHF. I use the same antenna on UHF for my vehicle, and when I had a mobile radio in there running about 45 watts out of UHF, I did do that test. I ran the thing, reset the TOT and the radio, mobile radio several times. I ran the thing till about 4 or 5 minutes. The antenna really didn't have any temperature to it. Because I thought of exactly what you said about the stainless steel possibly having a higher resistance than some other metal. But the antenna rod is made of stainless steel because they don't rust. But I never felt any heat come out of the antenna. Back to you.
Will you write to you? Hey, Mike. You're probably familiar with this antenna. We got a little bit of a mystery here. Let's see if you can correct us here. Professor Mike, give it ahead. WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening to all. Actually, no, I don't. I've been listening for a bit, and I may have a second-order effect, but I have a question to ask Joe or anybody who might be familiar with the mechanical connections that are inside of this mount. For example, here's what I want to know. Coax cable like RG58 will come into the, I guess, on the side somewhere of this mount, and usually what most VHF or even HF antenna mounts do, right away they have, with almost zero lead length, they drop the ground, the shield connection, right to the closest piece of metal they can get to. All right, but now you got to take the center conductor, and somehow it has to get to the center of the antenna rod. And that might be, I don't know, a little bit of distance away, and I was wondering if Joe or anybody could answer me approximately how long that that center conductor would be before it finally connects to the antenna, because you no longer have a piece of coax anymore. Now you have a piece of number 22 gauge wire, which acts like a series loading coil of so many nanohenries. So I'm wondering if it's a second order effect that we're seeing. So anybody who wants to chime in there, Dick, I'd like them to answer that question. WY2U.
And Joe, I'll bet you've taken apart that base and you've actually seen that wiring. So make a rough guess. What's the length of the unshielded center conductor in the base of that NMO? W-A2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
W-A2RYY, let's see. I'd say it's about a little more than a quarter inch between the shield, the edge of the shield, and the center pin of the antenna, which is why you're soldering your center conductor of your RG-58-2. The length of that pin going through the antenna mount itself is probably less than a quarter inch. You really can't, you can look at it, and it has a nylon insulator between it and the outside frame of the antenna itself, and it's kind of flat when it gets to the other side, which is meant to touch the bottom of the antenna. But all the mounts are made the same. They're all used on throughout either low band, high band, or UHF. So if it has some inductance within the cable itself, it would probably be indeed very, very small.
But you're describing physical length. If the RG58-like cable, maybe it's RG223, comes into the side of the metal mount and the shield gets grounded immediately, then the center conductor has to go over to the center, and maybe it's a quarter of an inch long, the center conductor of the cable with just some outer insulation on it, the dielectric material, then maybe another quarter of an inch to go through the feed-through network of the base of the NMO before it finally picks up the whip. We're describing close to an extra half inch of total length in the base before you hit the whip. That could be the missing length you're looking for, Joe. The B2LYY, T2LAW.
Well, undoubtedly, there is length between the center conductor of the RG58 and when it finally actually gets through to the other side. But remember, these cables are standard cables. They're only like 17-something feet long, 17 feet 3 inches long, something like that, I believe. Something close to that. But they use it for a variety of antennas. And you can have not only a quarter-wave antenna on the thing, you can put a loaded antenna for low-band or high-band operation, like a gain antenna or an I-band. So the cable is a standard cable. It's not specifically used for this type of antenna with the matching pigtail at the bottom. There are others that would have a tab that touches the top of the antenna mount on the inside of the antenna itself. So they are used for a variety of applications. Whether it's contributing that much to the length of the antenna, this is why I'm bringing the subject up. Maybe it is.
I'm going to speculate from what I'm hearing that yes, all of those NMO bases are built the same. But I think there's close to a half inch of unshielded center conductor built into that base NMO, and all of the whips that you put on for all of the bands and all of the quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, whatever, they're all designed with that extra length in mind, because that's the way you physically design the base of that NMO. Is that possible, Joe? To B2LYY, K2LAW?
Yes, that's possible. I remember seeing the antenna on top of your vehicle. It seems to be a magman antenna at probably 2 meters. It looks like it's a gain antenna, half wave or 5/8 length. Now, did the length of that antenna work out correctly for you when you tuned the antenna, or did it somehow you had to tune it to make it work correctly and the length didn't work out formula-wise as you thought it would be?
You. I've got to go measure mine. I've never measured it physically. I've never measured it visually. And Mike, WY2U, K2IW, go ahead, Mike.
I'm going to stick my neck out here a little bit. And Joe, let's say you underestimated the length of that unshielded piece of coax, you know, extending out the bottom of the RG58 or 223, whatever it is. And let's say it's 3/4 of an inch. Because there's another 1/4 of an inch that you're not seeing and it's somewhere else. That amounts to, believe it or not, at 156 megahertz. Let's assume it's about 15 nanohenries or so of parasitic series inductance. That's about 15 ohms of reactance there, Joe, which is a small loading coil, like it or not, series with the bottom of that antenna. One way to unravel the Brown and Woodworth curves is to rearrange them a little bit and come up with a plot of ohms reactance change per, let's say, 1% change in antenna length. For an antenna of the diameter to length proportion that you're talking about, it works out to be about 5 ohms of difference per 1%. So if the reactance changes by 15 ohms, as I'm projecting, due to that 3/4 of an inch, it would force you to roughly have to shorten that antenna by about 3% to achieve the same degree of resonance. I don't know if that's all of what we're looking for, Dick, but it certainly could be a good portion of it. So back to net, WY2U.
Now, maybe I've been living under the wrong rock, Joe, Mike. rate in my career as an antenna designer that I suddenly discovered the Brown and Woodworth curves. The words you just used led me to believe that you've been using them throughout your career. Who exposed you to the Brown and Woodward curves? How did you get that magic piece of information that wasn't given to me? I was living under the wrong rock. Who are you, Mike? K2RIW.
No, I don't think so. But actually, believe it or not, I believe where they came from the first time I was exposed to them. I forget the original antenna handbook that I got, but it was a very small paperback, ARRL publication back in the 60s. It was the old brown one, which had the brown cover. I think my cover wore off, and I finally threw it away. One of the antenna articles, and gosh, I don't remember which one it was, had an appendix, and sure enough, it led me to the IEEE handbook, where there were a condensed portion of the IEEE, the Brown and Woodworth curves, and I saw them kind of published in a way that showed reactance change for 1% change in antenna length. I remember that vividly. Dick, it had to be about 35 years ago, so where it's at right now, it might be in the ITT handbook. I'll take a look when we hang up here, but I honestly did that so long ago, I really don't remember. Back to you, WY2U.
Brown and Woodward published their original measured material, IEEE proceedings, or that it was, I don't know if it was called, IEEE proceedings, roughly 1945. So it's been a lot of references. Every single issue of the four issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, JASIC Engineering Handbook, 1961, has it in Chapter 3. All other editions have it in Chapter 4. So it's in every issue of Antenna. Antenna Engineering Handbook, probably in the ITT handbooks that came way before, and it was originally in 1945. I can tell, though, that it's a well-kept secret for the following reason. December of 2013, I'm sitting at Hazeltine, as I call them. You know what their name really is. And I'm listening to a beautiful lecture on antennas. I can't think of the man's name right now. Very well-respected guy who worked for the Wheeler Laboratories, and he became chairman of the board, I think, of Hazeltine. Anyhow, he's giving a lecture on antennas. And I asked a question, and the part of the answer was, hey, you can confirm this with the Brown and Woodward curves. The Brown and Woodward curves will tell you that real antennas with real diameters, the so-called equivalent schematic diagram that everyone uses, which supposedly represents the real impedance of a dipole antenna. You plug in all the numbers to this great big equation, and you're supposed to get the impedance of an antenna. Let me drop it. Everyone wants to believe that that is a derived equation. It is not. It's a curve-fitting equation. It's a cubic spline equation. It's a cubic spline that only fits a certain region of the very narrow diameter antennas out of the Brown and Woodward curves. And if you're starting to use fatter antennas, it doesn't work. In other words, when you come up with an equivalent circuit for your dipole, and you've got a certain number of inductors and resistors and capacitors, and you assume the inductors, resistors, and capacitors stay fixed as a function of frequency, you read the caveats that go along with that equation. It tells you that this equation only works if you're very close to the center resonant frequency of the antenna. It says those words. Everybody ignores those words. So what I'm getting at is, I'm sitting in this lecture, and I'm giving questions to the lecturer, and I'm telling him that you can't use that equation for that bandwidth that was being used, and you can tell right away that it doesn't fit the Brown and Woodward curves. The Brown and Woodward is real measured data out of Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. A whole bunch of the antenna design engineers from Hazeltine were in that audience. They turned around to me and said, "What chapter is that in, the Antenna Engineering Handbook?" To which I said, "My goodness, they didn't know either." Over to you, Mike, WY2U, K2IW, and the TechNet.
That is a well-guarded secret, by the way, that the curves are only good for a very, very narrow region around resonance, and then really only accurate, as you say, for sort of infinitely thin dipole-like antennas. Now, what I'm not sure about, maybe you know, Dick, how accurate are they for a monopole antenna, which is actually what we are discussing here, not necessarily a dipole, but there's a lot of other factors, ground conductivity, ground dielectric constant, and all of that jazz that we're not even considering, or that Brown did not consider, because they had full-length, almost resonant dipole antennas. So actually, we're making some pretty rash assumptions here, too. But then again, for a first-order approximation, I gather they're okay, but maybe you can just answer that yes or no. Go ahead.
Yeah, I recommend you get a hold of any copy of the Antenna Engineering Handbook and look at those curves and look at the words that go with it. What Brown and Woodward did is they soldered off with a very large sheet of metal, and in the middle of that sheet of metal, as many wavelengths wide, they put a monopole. And the monopole, they made all the possible lengths, all the possible diameters, and in those days, with a real slotted line and a real Smith chart and a frequency meter, they measured the real resistive component and the real reactive component. Those curves, in my opinion, in 1945, when they did that work, represent a man-year of work, in my opinion, or damn close to it. They did a lot of effort. And they admit immediately that the base stray reactances, in other words, they brought the various monopoles straight down to the center conductor and didn't concern themselves with whether or not the bottom of it was slightly rounded or squared or whatever. They admitted to you that there is some error because of the exact amount of stray reactants at the base where it's being fed, right in the center of this great big sheet of metal. But since every dipole is a thoroughly symmetric device, and therefore you can put a sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole at right angles to it, and you make absolutely no change to the impedance, the gain, the pattern, nothing changes. Let me drop this. And once you convince yourself that that's true, you don't have to feed a dipole. You can decide to feed one half of the dipole, reference the sheet of metal, and now you and I call it a ground plane antenna. Brown and Woodward measured ground plane antennas. It's not that they made a dipole and you make monopoles out of it. They measured monopoles, and you take the Brown and Woodward numbers and you double them for resistive component and you double them for reactive component if you then use them to make a dipole. In my mind, a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. Brown and Woodward measured monopoles. There are other curves of Brown and Woodward a few pages downrange where now they start making cone-shaped and diamond-shaped monopoles. But for the straight wire of various diameters and various lengths of monopole, they measured monopoles, though, Mike. WY2U, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, excellent. Very good. Thank you very much for the fill. Appreciate that. All right, now, I gather, the question I got then to Joe or whoever, back to the net here, is that 3/4 of an inch that I had been supposing, is that 15 ohms of reactance? Is the 3% that I calculate using this percent reactance change per percent, 1% antenna length of 5 ohms, would 3% give rise to that supposed length error that Joe was witnessing? Because that's really the matter at hand, I think, at this time there, Dick. WY2U, go ahead.
Yeah, my impression is that what Joe is bringing to our attention is a very well-designed, highly manufactured Motorola-like product, maybe Motorola product, been around for a long time. It's got a damn good track record. It works. Our mathematics may be a little bit hokey, and it's not working to us at first. It's a real antenna. And I think we're slowly resolving the mystery as to why the apparent length appears to be too short. And I'm convinced that some of that missing length is really in the base of that NMO structure, Joe. And you brought a beautiful mystery to our attention. The P2LYY, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Because I like keeping the gray matter in the pink. That's why. It makes us all think. And what Mike brought out may be the answer to it. And they may have actually designed these antenna rods per band to actually take that inductance, however small it would be, into account to make the antenna come out right on the money. Now, I guess this is the last question of this general question within the scope of it. Is there meter a way of calculating or estimating how long you'd have to make an antenna for theoretical quarter wave antenna if you took the velocity factor normally into consideration and normally have the antenna to be, say, a quarter wave antenna at a certain frequency with the same thing impedance is nominally 36 ohms. To raise that to 50 ohms, you say you have the length of the antenna. Is there a way to calculate that to know it has to be so much percentage-wise to raise the impedance so much? Is there a way of doing that or not really?
You've asked a darn good question, and for the time being, I'm going to answer a different question. That extra length that Mike has brought to our attention, that's physically present in the base of every damn one of those NMO base mount structures, so well accepted and so well manufactured by Motorola. Do you consider it an extra series inductance? Do you consider it an extra physical length? Answer is yes and yes. It's all of the above. On top of that, the portion of the center conductor of the RG58 that enters the base of that antenna, for shielding reasons as well as no other reasons, it has the dielectric material, your polyethylene, so to speak, is left on that wire where it goes from the outer perimeter where it's grounded until it gets over to the center. That extra polyethylene on there, although the extra coax shield, the braid is not on the outside of it, it still is giving you a partial velocity factor. Your polyethylene cable's got a velocity factor of 66%. When you remove the outer braid, but you still got the dielectric material on the center conductor, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, maybe the velocity factor is 80%. But what I'm getting at is, electronically speaking, there's a hell of a lot more length. As far as the percentages of error you're looking for, there's a hell of a lot more electronic length, physical length, in the base of that NMO, and I think we're going to eventually find out that's part of the mystery. Let me drop.
And I had a question, Dick.
John recognized. And now, the next question you've asked is, how much extra length do you have to add in order to make 35 ohms, base of a ideal monopole, go up to 50 ohms? And is that extra length, electronically speaking, it only has to be there electronically. And there's three or four ways you can electronically add the length to make the resistive component of a monopole go from 35 ohms to 50 ohms. That physical length that you have to add can be a combination of a little bit of the top half capacitor because of the bulb on the top, the velocity factor of the polyethylene on a little piece of half inch of center conductor that's in the base, plus the feed through that goes through the Teflon of the base before it finally picks up the curlicue. And there's still a missing, let me think now, extra length would make it inductive, there's a missing capacitor, but all of that curlicue has enough physical size to it, when compared to the grounding of the NMO, it is a stray capacitor. You've got all the structure there. It's hidden mechanically. It's been hidden in plain sight all this time. Let me drop it. To make a monopole go from 35 ohms to 50 ohms, you add a little bit of extra length, and you add a little bit of extra base capacitance, and it all comes out right, and I think all of that is built into every one of those NMOs, and they've designed for it. That's my guess. Obviously, it's a very successful design. When you've got all that success, they're doing something right. We just got to figure out what the hell's really going on. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dickie, yeah, I think you just mentioned and covered what I was going to say. Don't forget, that little piece of coax that just has the polyethylene on it, where it's soldered, it's going through a feed-through capacitor, actually. So that capacitance, a couple of puffs have to be taken into consideration. Also, I had a question on the construction. You're looking at the picture itself. From the description now that you're mentioning, I imagine if you were to pull that antenna out of the rubber base, you could stand it on that little circular bend that it has. Is that correct?
Give that man a cigar. You've got it. As long as it's well balanced, you can stand it on that curly cue. John, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, very good. Now I understand what that construction looks like, because I was having a great difficulty. Joe was trying to explain it. First of all, I didn't realize it came all the way down, and that little ring, which it makes a partial ring, is actually sitting on the NMO when it makes the contact. So now I have a complete picture of it.
And to extend, so that combination is giving us some extra length and some extra strain capacitance. You put it all together, and you got a beautiful 50-ohm match. You got a question on this one, Wes? N2XJN, K2IW.
That is perfect gear for me. I would like to be putting a list for space report. I have a subject to discuss, and then another subject in the meantime. Two of them interesting. Thank you.
Okay, Wes. And 2 weeks ago, I think we did go back to you, and unfortunately, we had waited so long that we had put you to sleep, unfortunately. Let's see now. The next person who's on the list is Rich. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Good evening. Here we go. I wanted to mention an antenna. Simple thing. It's a dipole antenna I purchased. Reason I purchased rather than built a wheelchair when I'm an amputee, so very hard to get around for me. But anyway, I come called Cobra Compact and Cobra Compact Antenna. W2KJI, the KJI Electronics recommended it. What it looks to be, it's not up yet. Very string it. It's 73 feet or 10 meters. It looks like it's made out of conductor motor cable. I think what they're doing. You think what they're doing, you don't take on a lot of stagger tune it, not a resonant needed, stagger tune it, which you can make three model on it. It's like $89 down to 80 meters. They got a shorter one that goes with a wider line. Those not familiar. Battle line is also battle line. Balanced line, I think. Needed with an anchor, well, pricey, $89. It's gonna serve. And the question I have, Dick, now when I'm on the antenna, it's up 3540. He said, get out of the 80. Your copper on the outside jacket, but the outer brain. I don't know which is better, because the older building here. Don't know. You can call that antenna. I will critique back to that.
Yeah, when it comes to that LMR-like cable, you're going to be happy with that. Very few people complain about that one. With that foil inside to keep the water away from the foam dielectric, and the foam dielectric has got a very low loss. It's an extremely high-performance cable. The only thing is a little bit difficult to put connectors on the end of it. Most people buy it with the connectors already installed to homebrew the connector installation. Sometimes it comes out a little bit hokey. Now, this Cobra Compact antenna, Cobra Compact antenna, is each half of the dipole made out of multi-conductor ribbon cable like the kind that's used for controlling a rotator. Is each half of the dipole multiple strands of ribbon cable? If so, I've got an explanation. Over to you on that, Rich, N2EO, K2LAW.
Stick. I didn't look to see if it gets progressively shorter. It's still coiled up, but took it out of the package. In fact, four conductor motor cable.
Okay, I've got to guess at what's going on. It really is electronically, I'm guessing, a fan dipole. In the case of a fan dipole, where you've got reasonable spacings out at the end where you fan them out, your 80-meter dipole is going to be damn close to 132 feet long, and the 40-meter dipole is going to be damn close to 65 feet long, and so on. When you start moving them closer and closer together, so that now the tip capacitance between the individual dipoles starts expanding real fast, At first, you'd be knocking them way out of resonance, but if you're smart enough to readjust the lens, get it back into resonance. All that's required for the signal to be radiated, as you've heard me say so damn many times, and it's not written in any of the good books, you resonate first, then it will radiate by ham radio standards, not by EMI standards, that's something else. So as long as each one of those individual strands, the 80-meter strand, the 40-meter strand, the 20-meter strand of the ribbon cable, are cut to the right length to hit resonance, even though they're packed together so damn tight, there's a hell of a lot of mutual capacitance between the two. That's just a difficult tuning job. There's been a couple of articles. Let me drop them. Way back in the dark ages when that ribbon cable was very popular for feeding rotators, there were a number of articles telling you if you take X number of feet of ribbon cable and you cut the upper one this long and you cut the next one down this long and the next one down this long, you will make a fan dipole at 80, 40, 20, and 10, so to speak. And maybe there's a 15-meter one in there. So it is a fan dipole, but it's now so damn much shorter. It's compact because of the intentionally made capacitance between the ribbon leads because they're so close, and the ribbon rubber itself is a reasonably high dielectric material, which is giving it the capacitive loading along the length. It's giving it extra capacitance. The only thing that I'm a little bit mysterious about now is that in the case of a ribbon multi-fan dipole, I used to think that the 80-meter version had to be nearly full length. I am guessing there's some kind of a box in the center giving you the extra length for the 80-meter dipole, but the 40, 20, 15, and 10, you don't need extra length because they're being capacitively loaded by the close spacing to the 80. So the only thing that's mysterious to me is the length of the 80-meter dipole only being 75 feet, I think you said, instead of 130. Therefore, I think your center box for that particular band has a loading coil in that box, is my guess. Is there a box in the center that you know about, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW?
Oh, Dick. All it is a center insulator made out of plexiglass.
Huh. And each side looks like ordinary ribbon cable. You see, any modification to the ribbon cable cuts in funny places and so on. Over to you, Rich. What do you see when you looked at that?
Well, it's all coiled up. That's the way we shipped to the antenna itself and the ladder line. All coiled up neatly in a package. I'll let you know.
How do they physically support the tip of those dipoles? There's got to be some kind of an insulator out there that you put your rope over to your support structure. What do the tips look like? Maybe you can only see that if you uncoil it in the center. Over to you, Rich.
I'll find it, yes. There's also plexiglass insulation. You can use something heftier. Plexiglass insulation. And I purchased a whole bale of, I think it's nickel plated, I'm not sure, fire. It's 100 foot long, but I need, that's the way they sell it, $50.
In the next couple of days, I'm going to look up that Cobra compact antenna and see if I can tell from the physical, the photographs, description, and the electronic description and specification if I can figure out what's going on. I think I've got it all figured out except for the 80-meter dipole. How they squeeze that down to 75 feet, that's a little bit mysterious to me right now, but I guarantee it's got to resonate or it's not going to radiate, so... they found some way of making the dipole shorter and without a loading coil in the center because I only got a simple center piece of plexiglass. There's a little bit of a mystery there, but we'll resolve that. And if JKI has recommended it, I'm pretty sure it's not a farce. I'm guessing it's a pretty good antenna and you're going to be happy with it after Barry installs it for you. I know that John had a question on antennas. Let's see what his antenna question is tonight. KC2WGB. He's a guy we haven't heard from very often. He's a stranger. Go ahead, John. KC2LIW, detect that.
No,
know, Dick, I did not have a question, not yet. My only question was on Joe's description of what he was building there, or what he was examining. So back to you.
Okay, now, was there someone else? Was it KD2HUC? I thought there was one more guy. Yeah, I think it's Eric. I think Eric had an antenna question tonight. KE2EJ, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Comment on Rich's antenna, KTPS.
West to end.
Okay, we're going to pick up Rich and then Paul in that order. K2EJ.
It's about me again.
Okay, I turned it over to you. I know you had an antenna question, and I know that Rich wants to give us some information on the previous one. I'll turn it over to you for that decision. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich. I mean, go ahead, Eric.
All right, this is something I've been thinking about since I've been dealing with slot antennas. Take a second and imagine a cylinder, okay? It's a hunk of metal that's closed on all sides, except there's a slot in it. And in the center, a quarter wave away from the edge of it, is a quarter wave vertical antenna. Now, the drum, which has the slot in it, rotates. What effect do you think that would have? K2IW, KE2J.
As you probably know by Batnett's rule, almost every ordinary antenna, which is a metal conductor put into an insulation called space, you do the reverse. You start up with a great big sheet of metal, and where the dipole would have been, you made a slot, and where the free space would have been, you make the sheet of metal. All of your antennas, there is a duality of that antenna by Batnett's rule. Okay, in the case of a so-called, I think it's called an Abe Lincoln top hat antenna, you've got this tubular chunk of sheet metal. If you were building it at 2 meters, the tubular chunk of sheet metal might be 8 inches in diameter, and it might be 2 feet long. And somewhere along the side of that tube, you've cut this vertical slot, and now you feed RF energy across that slot. It's going to be a horizontally polarized antenna on this vertical piece of metal. That's the one thing that's funny about Babnett's rule. You get the exact same pattern, the exact same gain when you make the duality antenna, except the polarization is orthogonal. Horizontal polarization becomes vertical. Everything else is the same. As long as your piece of tubing that I just described, let me drop it.
I think he said the antenna was in the center of that.
Okay. I'm making a vertical slot. You said in the center, okay? Are you putting a dipole inside of a piece of tubing? And if that's so, what stops that from being a shield? Run that by again, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Well, in dealing with slot antennas for transmission, and the way we have it organized around the mast, so to speak, so that you get the directionality that you want. You, in essence, have slots that are pointed every 90 degrees on an omnidirectional type antenna. Well, what if I just, let's say I wanted to just look at, and let me rephrase it this way. How narrow could I make the beam width of the slot, right? And rather than have multiple slots around facing each direction, I want to have one slot that I can mechanically rotate around the circumference of that cylinder. And that cylinder would be, you know, something that's grounded just like it would be on a slot antenna.
Okay. Ordinarily, you would put four slots on the four sides. 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 9 o'clock. And now you're describing an antenna where, in your experiment, you're only going to put a slot at 12 o'clock. And I'm guessing now you're describing a purely vertical slot as far as the way you cut that hole in the material. And I'm guessing that the circumference of your sheet of metal is small compared to a wavelength. Let me make sure that I got those two parts first correct before we proceed. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Right, Oh, I had a couple of different ideas. One is the traditional method of having a slot and a dipole directly behind it. But what if I made this drum like you would think of a cavity? Okay. And I make it so that the volume of that would be resonant. Well, not necessarily, because what I essentially want to do is have, I'll think of it this way. I want to have a vertical antenna in the center of this drum. The vertical antenna is a omnidirectional type of device. And essentially, I'm using the drum as a shield, so that way I only can peer out in one direction. I mean, does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense, Eric. On paper, by good common sense, makes a lot of sense. An amazing number of people have fallen into the trap that you have fallen into. It's going to take me a number of steps to describe the trap that many people have fallen into. In my early days, I fell into it. First of all, one step at a time. We're combining three or four different things here at once. Is the slot in the tubular piece of sheet metal, is that a vertical slot? And do you realize that the only way you can feed that slot
horizontal
will give it horizontal polarization? You admitting that one so far? Go ahead.
Yeah, I said it's got to be horizontal.
He said it's going to be horizontal. Very ambiguous words. Is the slot horizontal or is the polarization horizontal? Polarization is horizontal. And you put a dipole inside that. Your vertical dipole sees that slot as a perfect short circuit. Nothing will squirt out of that slot, even though it's a half wavelength long. Do I have to convince you of that before we proceed? Over to you.
No, that's the conflict that I was having, because if I do it the way I know we build slots for my TV antenna, that means I also have to make the feed line rotate with it. So, yeah. Because I know I can make the slot with a fairly narrow beamlet. Now, I'm only thinking of this theoretically, not as a practical device, but yeah, it's going to be horizontally polarized. To do the kind of thinking like a lighthouse or something that sweeps across the sky in the vertical domain is a bit more interesting.
Yeah, you're about to become fairly fairly disappointed if I'm half right in what I'm about to tell you. That slot is purely horizontally polarized. Try feeding vertically polarized energy out of it. You will not succeed. And when it comes to the beam width you've seen with the slot arrays that you're using on your broadcast station, because those vertical slots are stacked in a collinear manner along a significant length of tubing, you've got a lot of vertical real estate.
Yeah, this mine is 64 feet.
Okay, that's a lot of vertical real estate. A lot of wavelengths of vertical real estate. Therefore, that's giving you an extremely narrow pancake pattern. Narrow in elevation pattern, but 360 degrees in an azimuth pattern.
That's why I got little holes on the bottom to push something down towards the ground.
Your so-called fill-in for the people that are nearby, understand? What's the technical name you use for that Empire State Building? Those extra antennas to pick up the people that are nearby?
It's like 2 degree down tilt.
Okay, down tilt. But there's a fancy word you guys in the broadcast industry use for the extra function you've added to the antenna to give you fill-in under the umbrella for the people that are nearby. What's that function called?
Oh, I know it is down tilt. You know, that's how the antenna manufacturers denote it. You can get it 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees.
Yeah, the overall pattern can make it with down tilt. And that favors the people somewhat closer. But the antenna itself has got a rather narrow vertical beam width. You need a separate structure in some cases to fill in the people that are only a couple of miles away from Empire. They're underneath the pattern, if you know what I mean. All right, so we haven't thought of those words. What I'm getting at is that the amount of wow, and wow is the word that the antenna people use, if you rotate the antenna in azimuth and look at the increase and decrease in signal strength that you get, they call that wow. When it comes to an antenna that's intentionally made for omnidirectional coverage in azimuth, that slot that you draw at 12 o'clock, you like to think that the signal comes squirting out at 12 o'clock and nothing comes out at 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Oh boy, not true. Because the circumference of your piece of tubing, in your particular example, because your circumference is not a wavelength, it's significantly less than a wavelength. In your particular case, you're willing to put slots all over the place at 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 4 o'clock, you've got slots all the way around. Therefore, in your particular case, you're able to make the circumference more than a wavelength, and it can come out right. The majority of these Abe Lincoln top hat antennas, the circumference, if you take a cross-section through your piece of tubing, let me drop this. Your circumference is significantly less than a wavelength. Very similar to what happens if you take a loop antenna that is significantly smaller than a wavelength in circumference. That loop antenna, significantly smaller than a wavelength, looks a little bit like a dipole that you fold it around 360 degrees. You take the two ends of the dipole and you fold it each one 180 degrees around, if you know what I mean. You'd like to believe that antenna is going to have a similar pattern to a dipole. Well, when you make that circumference very small compared to a wavelength, and it's a highly inductive antenna, but you re-impedance match it, it becomes almost an omnidirectional radiator. So your piece of tubing is really a whole bunch of loop antennas that are smaller than a wavelength, and they're all vertically stacked. Even though you've only got a slot at 12 o'clock, the amount of signal that you're radiating at 6 o'clock will probably be 3 dB down. Why is that? When you look at your piece of tubing, from a horizontal polarization point of view, if you take a slice, you look at the shadow it casts. How much horizontal real estate is in that shadow in wavelengths? The only way you get directivity pattern in either plane, horizontal or vertical plane, you must establish real estate at right angles to that plane. If you've got a whole lot of height to the antenna, then you have a whole lot of capability of having a very narrow vertical beamwidth. In order to make a horizontal narrow beamwidth, you'd have to have a whole lot of horizontal real estate. You ain't got that. That's going to be nearly omnidirectional. So you've got a slot at 12 o'clock. I'll bet you the signal you radiate at 6 o'clock is only going to be 3, 4, 5 dB down. And so if you're now going to rotate this, you think it's going to act like a Yagi. You ain't got anywhere near enough horizontal real estate to establish any substantial amount of horizontal directivity. You see where I'm going with that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW. It's a good question, by the way.
That's what my thinking was, and I wanted to throw it at you because sometimes you think something is right, and then you find out you're wrong. So, I was thinking about a number of different ideas in terms of being able to do a couple of different things. And one of them is actually taking like an 11-element beam and rotating it. It's a little unwieldy, but when you got that kind of front to back, you can be a little more secure in terms of beamwidth versus distance. So, all right. Well, thank you for your thoughts. K2IW, K2J.
And taxi. Your 11-element beam, you didn't tell me what frequency you're operating on. And the zoom is not 20 meters because you don't want to establish...
VHF and UHF.
VHF and UHF. Okay. Is it
going to do with VHF?
Something at VHF. What was that again?
It's easy to do at UHF because everything's so much smaller, but it's a little harder to do at VHF, but it can be done.
Well, 11-element Yagi on 2 meters, for instance, for a guy who's serious, I think it would come out with something like a 28-foot long boom. Are you willing to radiate? Are you willing to rotate a 28-foot long boom? And if you're willing to properly gravity balance it and wind balance it, it becomes easy. N2MB has done it on a number of occasions. Back to you on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
The amount that we came up with is kind of interesting. let's put it this way, it ain't using the regular